We have come before and assembled before you today in worship. And of course, we don't come alone. We come with all of those who have gone before us, that great cloud of witnesses, those people who have run the race and who have gone to be with you. And so together with them, together with the angels, we praise your name. And we would ask that you would come down and dwell with us this morning and also enlighten our hearts and our minds as we seek to better understand the story behind the faces that we see in that crowd of witnesses. Hear our prayer in Jesus' name. Amen. So, my friends, are we on? It has been a few weeks, obviously a few months, actually, since we last talked about this topic, so I would like to go back a little bit and just do a real quick recap. Before that, I do want to throw out a few caveats about this. This is a church history course, if you will, sort of a survey. I want to make it clear that I don't know everything about church history, and so while this topic has been well researched, there may be insights that you have or things that that you know that I might have missed. There might be other issues where I might have made the odd mistake, but having said that, the topic was well researched. It's been based on a number of different books and writings, and so I think the data is accurate. Beyond that, I want to just take us back to where we were a few months ago. And we were talking about the challenges that the early church faced. But before we get too much into depth about that, I would like to share with you a passage from Scripture, one that you will undoubtedly know. And this comes from the book of Hebrews. And so if any of you know the chapter of Hebrews 11, which was that great chapter of heroes of the faith, right? You go through this whole chapter, Hebrews 11, and we learn all about the heroes of the faith that went before us. And then when chapter 11 is over and we get into Hebrews chapter 12, we read, "Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God." So we are not assembled today just as a group here within Menomonee Falls. We have with us, of course, those that have gone before, and we can imagine the great cloud of witnesses that the apostle speaks of here that are looking down and encouraging us on. So sometimes when we think about history, some people think about, oh, this is just a bunch of dates and other things that are not too exciting and I don't want to really bother with. We're not worried about dates and we're not worried with mundane details here. What we're doing is looking into that cloud of witnesses and we're looking into those faces because each one of them has a story and it's a fascinating story and it's worth knowing. So we're going to get to know these people a little bit better in that race that they ran and what they went through. And where, of course, there's a hero, there's also villains. So we're going to learn about a little bit about those villains, and we're going to learn about the race that they ran. And I think you're going to find, as I did when going through this, this has everything to do with who we are and how we live today. Okay? So without further ado, let's get into it. When last we met, we talked about a number of different broad topics. Okay, when we started out, we considered the book of Acts and other books of the Bible that describe the early church, the early Christians, and what they went through. And we read in those books that they had a great witness, that the church grew, but they faced a lot of persecution. Okay, and so initially, who was persecuting them? It was the Jewish leaders, right? So the Jewish leaders, we see the apostles being imprisoned, beaten, shipwrecked, and all this kind of thing. And that was the type of resistance that the church experienced in the early days. After this, we see the church being persecuted by Rome. So the early church, Rome looked at the Christian movement and said, this is part of Judaism. There's lots of Jewish folks out there. Judaism is protected. And so the church was able to kind of ride in the shirt tails of Judaism, as it were, in terms of their protection under the state. The state didn't persecute them. Initially, that changed as it became more and more clear that Christianity was, in fact, not Judaism. And so that persecution and the focus of the persecution moved from the Jewish leaders to the state of Rome. And so we learned about all these different leaders of Rome, these different emperors, Nero and some of these other folks who we read about and all of their antics and how they persecuted the church. And one of the primary reasons behind that was the idea of reestablishing the dominance and glory of Rome. And they thought that if they were going to do that, then they needed to reestablish the people's following of the gods of Rome. And so this led to a lot of persecution. Wasn't the only factor. I think there are multiple factors. Another factor was just sometimes insanity. We read about Nero and all the things that he did. We don't need to go through that all again, but clearly there's something not right in their minds. And beyond that, Christians made a good scapegoat. There were some, the early church was small, it was weak, and when there was a problem, somebody needed a scapegoat, the city's burning, let's blame the Christians. And we all know that story, I think, from our past. So that's kind of where we came from. The other broad topics that we've talked about included some of the struggles that the early church had with respect to the doctrinal teachings, and we recall that the church had to struggle against that whole idea of Gnosticism, right? The idea that the physical creation is bad, that the physical creation was perhaps created by this evil demiurge, not the real supreme being, and therefore the physical world was not intended originally to be, and therefore it was bad, and that we have to struggle against that physical being so that we could be liberated through gnosis. And so those who were somehow involved with Gnosticism and had some inkling of Christianity, there was a certain amount of syncretism there where they said, okay, Jesus is now this great Gnostic leader, and he's going to give us salvation through special knowledge through which we will cast off the shackles of our physical being and become that spiritual being we were meant to be. So we talked about that, and we talked about issues like this. So this is one of the great early struggles that the church had. Moving beyond this, we talked about, okay, what did the church do about this? We read about the great church fathers that came along and their writings. We talked about the apologists and their writings and how they sought to set the record straight, okay? And so we talked about the great church fathers, and we talked about the early church creeds that were set up and against this idea of Gnosticism and ideas like that, and were developed to help teach and instruct people. So that brings us to today, right? Today, we're going to take that topic we're going to take the next chapter in that story and talk a little bit more about persecution. But then we're going to get to a pivoting point that came in the form of the Emperor Constantine, and we're going to get to him in a few minutes. But before we do that, let's cap off this story about persecution. So we talked about why the church was persecuted, and you might think, and I might think, that a persecuted group like this is going to be persecuted into non-existence, right? That was the goal of those who persecuted them. They wanted to destroy them. Is that what took place? Well, we read in the books of the Bible how many people were saved and how many people were brought to the knowledge of Christ. And so we see thousands of people coming to Christ even in the books of the Bible. And so the research that I've read indicates that there were over 10,000 Christians in AD 100. Again, not completely certain about these numbers, but they give you at least some sort of frame of reference. By a century later, when all of this early persecution was taking place, we went from 10,000 to 200,000. Okay, this is before the time where it was legal to be a Christian, right? 200,000 Christians. And a little over a century later, there were over 2 million Christians. And this is not in today's world where there were billions and billions of people out there, right? So this is amazing, spectacular growth. And this is before the time where it was legal or where it was allowed and popular to be a Christian. So the church absolutely exploded during this time of persecution, right? And so there was a Christian who once lived who made the statement that something along the lines that the blood of the martyrs was the seed of the church. You probably have heard that somewhere. And as we see from the numbers here, kind of bears that out. The early church grew and expanded significantly despite persecution. All this was to change in the person of Constantine, but let's wait with that story just a couple of minutes, because I'd like to talk about today's world, because we have a tendency to think, well, this persecution was terrible. We read about the Circus Maximus and how the Christians were set up as human torches and how all of these horrible events took place. And we think, thank goodness that we don't live in such a barbaric time. Unfortunately, things are not always as they seem, because for us in the United States, that's true, and for other countries where freedom of worship and freedom, these basic freedoms exist, but in other parts of the world, that is not the case. Oops, went too far. So I would like you to just look at some of these stats with me. How many Christians are persecuted today? 260 million Christians in countries where persecution is common experience high levels of persecution. This is an increase of 6% over 2019. So things are not getting better, okay? They're getting worse in terms of persecution. 2,983, almost 3,000 Christians were killed for the faith. 9,488 churches were attacked. 3,700 believers were detained without trial, arrest, or imprisonment during that time period. The leading factor of this is adherence to a Sharia law, and I think we've all heard about this, that strict interpretation of law in the Middle East and in Islamic countries. 83% of the global population lives in places with high religious restrictions. So think China, you know, think North Korea, think these Arabic countries, right? These Muslim countries. 500 million worldwide are persecuted for their faith. 65% of those are Christians. So Christian persecution did not end with the advent of Constantine. Okay, it is alive and well today, and more people are being killed today than were killed in those times. Pew Research indicates that Christians are harassed for the faith in 144 countries. By some reports, more Christians have died in the last 100 years than all the prior centuries combined since the time of Jesus' birth. So, folks, I cannot account for the veracity of these numbers, but what I do know is this, that persecution is alive and well today, and that things are, in fact, getting worse, and there are a lot of places where the church is struggling. Finally here, the last bullet point, Gordon Conwell's Center for Study of Global Christianity's annual report on the persecution of Christians say nearly 1 million Christians were martyred from 2005 to 2015. You can look at the source and look this up further if you wish. But the take-home story here is that persecution is alive and well today. Okay, so let's take the story, let's dial it back now and talk about the Emperor Constantine and what was going on during his ascent. And before we do this, let's just ask the question, who was Constantine? We know him as this emperor who, let's just say for the moment, converted to Christianity and took the empire with him. Constantine lived at a time when there were actually four emperors. There was a supreme emperor in the east. There is a supreme emperor in the west. These were titled Augustus, and each of these Augustus emperors had under them a Caesar. And the idea was that this was established in order to create an orderly succession. So if you can think about ancient times, whenever one ruler would die, there would typically be a lot of unrest. There would be even civil war as these various factions struggled. And so the idea was, you know, we'll set up this orderly transition where we have somebody in the east, somebody in the west, and then we have somebody under those guys. So when they die or something happens to them, they're incapacitated, there will be somebody waiting in the wings to take their place, and then somebody in the lower echelons then would replace those guys. And so this is what was going on when Constantine came to power. In fact, his father, his name was Constantius Chlorus, and he was not the Augustus, but he was the Caesar, the one under him in the western part of the empire. And Constantine himself was a military leader, and he worked and lived and was campaigning around what we would today call France and parts of Germany and the British Isles. And so if you've ever seen any of these movies where the Roman soldiers are all running around and they're fighting with these barbarians clad in all these horns and stuff, this was Constantine, okay? That was him. So a number of political events occurred, and we won't go through the whole spiel. You can read about that if you would like. But a number of events occurred which propelled Constantine to power. And basically what happened, if I take the Cliff's Notes version, is that Constantine's father replaced the Augustus that was above him. And when he died, Constantine was proclaimed emperor by his soldiers because he was really popular in the military and he was really powerful. And so because of that support that he had in the military from his friends and from those people he had a lot of influence over, he gained power. And once that happened, he was a very astute politician. And he had this dream and goal of not only being the Caesar there, but the dream and the goal of becoming the ultimate, most powerful emperor. And that he did. So through various machinations, he became the supreme Augustus in the West. And then he challenged his rivals in the East to the point where he was now the supreme ruler over the entire empire. And again, makes for a fascinating story. But what Constantine, the reason Constantine, of course, is interesting to us is not because of those things per se, but that because he was friendly toward the Christians. During the time when all of this was happening, Christianity was undergoing its worst persecution to date, okay? And that might be a little surprising to some of us because we all read about Nero. And we all know about the Circus Maximus, or at least maybe we've heard about it. But what was going on during this later time? Well, persecution was sporadic, and it happened in different parts of the empire at different times for different reasons. But the problems here originated in the military. So in that time, there were many Christians and Christian leaders who were against service in the military. I don't know exactly why this is, because we don't find any biblical injunction to not serve in the military. But I can imagine, of course, this is a brutal time that, of course, preceded our current notions of what would justify a just war. Much later, Augustine of Hippo came along, and he formulated this idea of just war, which I think still prevails with us today. So I can only imagine that a lot of the battles and the wars that in which these folks were engaged were ones that they might have had a crisis of conscience when they were fighting. And so the concern on the part of their leaders was, okay, what happens when we're trying to subdue these folks in Gaul or these German tribes, and these Christians decide that they're not going to fight, or worse yet, they side with our rivals. We can't rely on them. So it started out as an edict to expel folks from the military, okay? And it from there, things went from bad to worse. It went from expelling people from the military to persecuting people who were in the military and executing people in the military. And from there, things even spiraled out of control. Christians were expelled from government positions. Their books and their buildings were destroyed. There was a fire in the palace, and guess who was blamed? The Christians. Isn't this strange? It really reminded me of what Nero, we read about Nero, he's playing his fiddle when Rome is burning, and he's pointing at the Christians, right? So the Christians made an easy target back then. And it would seem that the thing happened again later in this eastern part of the Roman Empire. So Christians were blamed for this fire. And again, they made a convenient, I don't see any evidence that they were to blame, but they made a convenient scapegoat. So that brought on additional punishment from the Augustus. His name was Diocletian. And he and Galerius, who was the guy who was under him, I'm thinking I'm getting this all right, they began to persecute Christians more and more because of this. And so then it wasn't just soldiers, it wasn't just people in the palace, it was Christians everywhere. Their churches were being destroyed, their books were being confiscated, They were being put to death. And so you see here this image, perhaps you can see it, or you can see it in your handout, a painting of people being crucified at that time. So though there was this great persecution of and against the church, which began in the military for the reasons that we discussed, spiraled out of control, and then we see this great persecution taking place throughout the empire. All right, this was all going on when Constantine was a soldier, and now we see the events taking place that directly preceded Constantine coming to power. This person who was persecuting the Christians, this leader, Galerius, became ill. And so he had previously given this edict against Christians. And now, with his great illness that came upon him, he's saying, what do I do to better my situation? So he took back his edict, and he thought maybe the Christian God was after him. So he asked Christians then, in response for taking away his edict and rescinding his edict, he asked that the Christians would pray for him and for the empire. Well, I don't know if they did, and if they did, I don't know what the contents of those prayers were, but this guy ended up dying a very painful death. And so that was that, and the Christians were then allowed to once again practice their faith, and their buildings were returned and so on. And so this was a bit of a turning point, this edict from Galerius, or rather this rescinding of this edict of Galerius. Okay, so let's move on. And let's talk about Constantine. So Constantine, we talked about how he came into power, and how and why it is that he came into power and who he was. But again, the thing that is so fascinating to us is the role he played with respect to the Christian church. Constantine, while all of this was going on, and while he was consolidating his power, his goal, again, was to become the supreme ruler, first in the West and then later within the empire. So while he was contending against his rivals in the western part of the empire, he apparently had some sort of vision. And within this vision, he saw, he received a command, as it were, that he saw a symbol, and he said, in this symbol you shall conquer, or something to that effect. So I always had it in my mind that it was a cross that he saw, and that he was supposed to put a cross on his banner and his shields, but it wasn't the case. It was, let me read this so I make sure that I get it right. It was Chi and Rho, and so you see the symbol here on the screen, and hopefully you see it on your handouts there too. What is that? That is an early Christogram. That is a combination of letters that forms an abbreviation for the name of Christ. So these are basically a couple of letters that are superimposed over each other in Greek. Pastor Tony, if you're here somewhere, you're listening to this, hopefully this is all correct. I'm getting a thumbs up, so that's good. So he put this on his banner, and he went forth to fight under this symbol. Now, there are those critics who say, well, Constantine was taking advantage of the political situation, and he was using this only for political gain. He didn't really put any stock into it. But the facts don't really bear that out, because if you consider the Christian church at that time, Christians were a small minority. They were persecuted. The people who adhered to Christianity were tended to be the lower echelons of society. The people who he wanted to win over were pagans. The people who were senators in Rome were by and large pagans. So one struggles to see how fighting under this banner would have brought him any political gain. So the facts don't seem to bear it out. At the same time, I struggle a little bit with the idea that Constantine sees this vision. In any event, this is what he claims to have seen. This is what he did. He did fight under this banner. He put this Cairo on his banner. And it seems to have had an unnerving effect on his rivals, because they tended to shy away when they saw this banner and this symbol. So Constantine ends up supreme. He wins this there's this huge battle, this very important battle at a place called Melvin Bridge. And he later goes on to take complete power in the West, complete power in the East. He confronts his rival in the East, and they come up to an agreement. This agreement is called the Edict of Milan. That took place in 313 CE. He was not yet sole emperor, but at that point, he and this Eastern emperor come to the agreement that they're going to give Christians additional freedoms. And so this edict in Milan was a huge turning point in the church, because now the church was not made the official religion of the Roman Empire. As some, I always had the idea in my head that Constantine came to power and suddenly Christianity was the official religion of the empire. That was not the case. But the Christians did get their books back, their buildings back. They had the freedom to worship. And so this was a huge turning point for the church. So let's move on. Constantine then becomes sole emperor in 322 until his death in 337. And let's just go over some of the high points of his achievements. We don't need to go and spend a whole lot of time on this, but he was very, very influential. And a lot of the things he did impact us yet today. So we heard before about these various Roman emperors who wanted to reestablish the glory of the Roman Empire by turning people back to the gods of Rome. Well, Constantine also wanted to establish the glory and reestablish and assert the glory of the Roman Empire, but he wanted to do so through the power of the Christian God. Okay, so that is a key difference here. He decided to create a new and more glorious version of Rome, and this became the city of Constantinople. I will never forget when I was on a ship in sailing along the straits, the Bosporus Straits near Constantinople. I was sitting there reading a book, and I just happened to look up, and I see these magnificent spires of the Hagia Sophia, this old famous church that was built a couple centuries after Constantine, and it was one of the most poignant moments, I think, in my traveling life. Just to see this was amazing. But during the time of Constantine, you know, he put that city on the map, right? It was a smaller city, and he expanded it. So he was looking at the city, he looked at the walls, and it was much too small for his vision. So he wanted to expand the walls. So he took his entourage, and he circumvented the city, and he walked around it and showed the place where he wanted the walls to be and the city to be expanded to. And people were watching him thinking, this guy's crazy. The city is never going to need all this space. And so he's walking farther and farther and farther, and people asked him, well, how far are you going to go? And his response, I'm going to stop when the one that leads before me stops. So, to his Christians in the entourage, that meant, of course, that he was following Christ. And to the people who were pagans in his entourage, he was following the unconquered son or whoever it was that that they followed. But that was the idea. And so, he expanded the city of Constantinople, and he wanted to make this the most glorious city in the empire, because this was a strategically located place. It was right in the middle of things. He was close enough to the western part of the empire to be in striking distance of these rebellious Germanic tribes, but he was close enough to the eastern part of the empire to be able to deal with issues that arose there too. So it had strategic importance. And what he did, beyond expanding the walls, he made special regulations that made it very, let's say, business-friendly to move into Constantinople. A lot of people flocked into the city. And he had architecture from around the entire empire. Basically, he went around looting and pillaging the empire and took all of these great statues and works of art into Constantinople. There was this huge statue, I think of it was of Apollo, that he had placed in Constantinople. They removed Apollo's head and put Constantine's head on. So this guy's head got a little bit too big for him, as we might say. I know that was lame. Anyway. That was a dad joke, right, Adelina? So anyway, this was going on. Constantine established Constantinople. The city would play a role for centuries. We think about the Romans being sacked a few centuries after Christ, right? And the Germanic tribes, the Goths and the Vandals and Visigoths and all these folks came in and sacked Rome, and that was kind of the end of things. But it was not really the case. Pastor Tony probably teach this a lot better than I could. But the eastern part of the Roman Empire prevailed and lived on till the 1400s. So you think about 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. About 40 years before that, Constantinople was defeated by the Ottoman Empire, I believe it was. But that's a period of 1,000 years. Okay, so the Roman Empire was not dead. It was living on in the east in this city that Constantine established. And so he had tremendous impact. All right. Constantine's conversion. So at the beginning of our talk today, I kind of said, you know, we'll call it a conversion. It was an odd conversion, okay? What we know about Constantine is that he claims to have seen this vision whereby he saw a sign that said, in this sign you will conquer. We know that he put this on his standard and I think on his soldiers' shields, and they went in and they had success. We also know that he helped establish the treaty, the Edict of Milan that gave Christians freedom. But what about Constantine himself? Was he really a Christian? Historians are divided about this. But let's look at the facts. Constantine was a follower of a religion called the Unconquered Sun. This was not one of the biggies in Rome. This was not Apollo or Zeus or any of these other guys. This was a god, if you will, that was popular in the military, and so he followed this Unconquered Sun. And now he becomes friendly with the Christians. He sees this sign. Normally, if somebody's going to become a Christian, you would go undergo teaching. You would become a catechumen. You would learn catechism, which we still teach today with Westminster, right, in our tradition. And after this long period of tutelage under leaders and teachers in the church, you would be baptized, you would make a confession, and you would become a Christian. This did not happen. Constantine never underwent this catechetical teaching, and he was not baptized until he was on his deathbed. Historians look back and say, well, there could be various reasons for that, because in those days, people were often concerned and had the idea that if you were baptized, and after you were baptized, you committed some heinous sin, then that would not be covered by your baptism, and somehow then you would not be forgiven for this sin. So there was this idea that you should wait for your baptism until later. And so some people look at that and say that. But the waters here are indeed very muddy. So Constantine, in addition to not being baptized, not undergoing this catechetical teaching, he was a high priest of the Unconquered Sun during his life. And so as this Roman leader, he was a high priest of the Unconquered Sun. And he was later deified by the empire, and so he became a pagan god. So Constantine was a high priest of the Unconquered Sun. He was a god himself in Roman tradition. So he was glorified as both of these things. And then to make matters even more interesting, he became canonized by, I think it was the Eastern Orthodox Church. And so he was a Christian saint, a pagan god, and a high priest of the Unconquered Sun. Where does that leave him? Not in a place that I would want to be. But at any rate, do know is that he was regarded as somebody who was very friendly with the church. And we might be able to relate to that today. We have a lot of leaders, won't name any names, but throughout my lifetime, before my lifetime, where leaders have paid a lot of lip service to Christianity. Some were friendly toward Christians, weren't always necessarily Christians themselves. And so I think this might have been the case with Constantine. He was friendly toward Christians. He feared the Christian God. That much is clear. He feared the power of the Christian God, didn't always seem to serve him. Having said all of this, to make things even more bizarre, he considered himself to be the bishop of bishops and never hesitated to involve himself within the running of the church. Okay, so whenever there was a great theological issue to be addressed. He became involved, and he made his pronouncements, and so the situation was a little bit strange. All right, let's move on. Interesting story, though, yeah? A lot of this we've already gone through, so we won't spend too much more time on it. Constantine seemed to be a sincere man with a meager understanding of the Christian faith, but he believed in the power of the Christian God. He put an end to persecution, and he returned the church property. He later even donated a palace in Rome to the church. I forget who it was that church, palace belonged to. I think it was one of his relatives. Did not go down very well with his family, but anyway, he did what he did. The official religion was and remained paganism, and Constantine was a pagan high priest. He appointed many Christians to high positions in the government, and so his impact was profound. All right. Next slide. I am sorry. There we go. AD 324, we talked a little bit about the earlier edicts, Edict of Milan. 324, soldiers were ordered to worship the Supreme Being on the first day of the week. And here we are on the first day of the week, 2021. I can't believe it's 2021. I had to catch myself. It almost said 2020, but... Here again, the waters are a little bit muddy because the first day of the week was, of course, the day of Jesus' resurrection. It was also the day of the unconquered Son. So here we see, you know, it could go one way, it could go the other in terms of the importance to the people. 325, ecumenical council took place in Nicaea. We've all heard of the Council of Nicaea, right? We're going to study that later. Constantine put imperial property at the service of the council. He built new lavish churches. So again, we think about where did Christians worship? We talked about and we read about the house churches, right? When we look at the book of Acts and other books of the Bible, people were worshiping in house churches. Later, when Christians were persecuted, sometimes they gathered in catacombs, you know, or in safe places where they were secluded and could somehow worship in peace. Now, we went from that to Christians being given these lavish new buildings. Okay, up until this point, Christianity, I think we can establish that it was a persecuted minority. Now we have a radical change taking place. Christianity went from being a persecuted minority to being accepted and then to being promoted. Okay, so... he didn't make Christianity the official religion of the empire. He was and remained, in some sense, a pagan, but he favored Christianity. His offspring favored Christianity in some form. And later we see in 382, the government stopped supporting paganism. 391, pagan sacrifice was outlawed. Of course, it continued, but anyway, it was now outlawed, so the shoe's on the other foot. 392, pagan worship was forbidden. Now Christianity was favored, and pagan temples were often demolished or sacked, sometimes by Christians. Okay? So again, the shoe is now on the other foot, and so we see the pagans starting to be persecuted. There we go. Okay, what other effects do you have? The church leaders... went from being very simple people that wore common dress, that worshipped in houses or catacombs or other safe places. Now they were given these highly adorned robes that they would sometimes wear, these bishops would wear. They were given vast lands by Constantine, by the empire. 1,800 bishops and other clergy were tax-exempt and also didn't need to perform the public labor required of others. So they're really being favored. Bishops were given free access to imperial posts, and now we see something that is really quite dangerous taking place because the church flourished at a time when they were persecuted, and not everything was always good, but the church did flourish and it did grow. Now we have a new challenge. The church is now favored. People are being promoted. Church leaders are given government positions. They're exempt from taxes. They're given judicial powers. What do you think happened then? A certain amount of corruption, right? With this power, somebody once said, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. The more power these people got, the more corrupt the church became. So the new dangers that threatened the church, now that it was powerful, were in some ways greater than the dangers that threatened the church when the church was a small harassed minority. Okay, so we've talked about the church leadership, and please, I don't want to give the impression here that this was universal, that all of the church leaders were corrupt, that this corruption was universal, but I do want to give I do want to impart that this change from being a harassed minority to being surrounded by pomp did have in some ways a negative impact on the leadership of the church. Now let's talk a little bit about the laity. So you can imagine what happens when the church becomes the popular place to be if you want to be in favor with the emperor. People flocked into the church. The church couldn't keep up with the growth, right? So if we think about what it took to become a Christian in ancient days, we talked about this process of catechism, where people would be catechumens and they would learn the instruction over a long period of time, and only after they had learned that instruction and demonstrated the sincerity of their faith would they then be allowed to join the church and be baptized. Well, so many people were joining the church that the church could not keep up with all of the people who wanted to join. And so, as happens in business, in the business world, if a process can't keep up with what you want it to do, the process is streamlined. And that's what happened in the church. This process of becoming a church member was streamlined. I have been to churches in my life where to become a member of the church, you show up on whatever day it was, your first day, and they would take your name and you were now a member of the church. Not the way we do things here at Falls, and not the way that they historically did things. But the church leaders could not keep up with all of these people, so this process was streamlined. The time to become a Christian and be baptized was shortened, and so you had all of these pagans coming into the church, and what do you think they took with them? Their whole worldview, their ideas. And so you look at the ancient church, and you have the ideas of paganism coming into the church, including, for example, the veneration and the belief in the power of relics. You know, we've all heard of relics, the bodies or parts of the bodies or the bones of deceased saints. So in older times, Christians would gather in cemeteries or in catacombs because they could worship there without being bothered. And they also liked to be near those that had gone before them. But in time, this was kind of mixed with pagan ideas, and people came to venerate and to believe in the power of these bones. And so the church unearthed, in some cases, these bodies of these saints that had died, and they placed them near the foundation of churches that they would build. And so people would come because of these relics sometimes. And they came to believe in the power of these relics. The story is told about Helena, I think she was the mother of Constantine, believed in the relics, had a vision, so it said, of the cross of Christ, where the Christ's cross was buried. So she set out and made an expedition to recover that cross that she saw in her vision. And lo and behold, of course, the cross is there. And they dig up this cross, and it wasn't long before pieces of the true cross were found throughout the length and breadth of the Roman Empire, and people were flocking to see it and to get a part of it. And so now you have people believing in these power of these relics. How do you go from being taught the books of the New Testament to believing in the saving power of St. Helena's pinky bone? How does that happen? Well, there's a number of reasons, but part of the way that it happens is when you stop focusing on Christian education and catechism, and you just accept people in without having duly gone through this process and tested and verified their understanding of the faith and the sincerity of their confession. And so that is why that we at this church and with our tradition are very focused on education. That's why we're having Christian education here today. That's why we catechize our children. And if you don't do this process, you bring in these false ideas into the church. And if you do that enough, those ideas become integrated into the DNA of the church, as it were, and people believe that. Not only the rank and file laity, but the leaders themselves. And so you might think, well, this tripe could not have lasted long. But 1,000 years later, during the time of the Reformation, we still find this going on.
Sure.
Yeah. And the reliquaries as well, perhaps.
In my house, someplace is a part of the body of one of the popes.
So
that one of my sons got in Catholic church. It was given to him for some reason or other, you know. And I'm like, what do we do with that thing? You know, I don't know if I still have it or not. But I mean, that's
kind of interesting in a morbid sort of way. So for those of you who can't hear or maybe are streaming, Bill is talking about, you know, his experience that, you know, he actually went through this in his own life. And of course, it's 2021, and this was fairly recently that he experienced this in his own family, in his own church where he previously went. And so these ideas are with us today. And thanks for your insights there. I really appreciate that. Because we fast forward 1,000 years from the time of Constantine, and Luther was struggling with this. So allow me to just read to you the writing here of Luther as he struggled with the same issue. The chapels in the forest and the churches in the fields, such as Wilsnack, where the blood of Christ could be found, Sternberg, more blood of Christ, Trier, the seamless garment recovered by Helena, mother of Constantine, and housed there at Trier, Grimmental, where an image of Mary cured people of syphilis, and now Regensburg, various relics and a bit of the true cross. So the true cross was still floating around then, and a goodly number of others which recently have become the goal of pilgrimages must be leveled, says Luther. Oh, what a terrible and heavy reckoning those bishops will have to give who permit this devilish deceit and profit by it. They should be the first to prevent it, and yet they regard it all as a godly and holy thing. They do not see that the devil is behind it all, to strengthen greed, to create a false and fictitious faith, to weaken the parish churches, to multiply taverns, harlotry, to lose money and working time to no purpose, and to lead ordinary people by the nose. If they had read Scripture as well as the damnable canon law, they would know how to deal with this matter. Luther's words, not mine, but you see the point. And Bill made the point about, you know, his experience. I remember when I was a student in Germany, and I was visiting the great dome or cathedral of the city of Worms, where Luther was tried, near where I lived. And in this cathedral, there was a reliquary, and in this reliquary was some sort of, I don't even remember what was in it, but I just had this morbid fascination with this thing that had its own little chapel. And I was trying to remember what was in it, so I did what I always do, and I asked Siri, but she didn't know. So it's a little surprise, because I thought Siri knew everything. But at any rate, this is not to throw stones, folks. This is not to castigate anybody, but this is just to say that ignorance is a bad thing when it's brought into the church. It's a bad thing when Christian education does not flourish. It's a bad thing when we are not very serious about instructing our youth. I don't think a whole lot of us you know, believe in the saving power of deceased saints' bones, maybe some of us have that heritage like Bill was talking about, right? But even if we don't have that, we have other baggage that we bring with us because, you know what, the pagan world that those folks grew up in and the ideas that they took with them, still alive and well, and we take our own baggage with us today. It might not be that idea, but it's other ideas that are just as false. And so we need to hold up this falsehood in the clear light of day, in light of the scripture, and we need to address it, and we need to teach clearly, which is what we do, or we try to do. And we need to be very, very careful when we take people into the church that their eyes are completely wide open and that we've addressed issues like this. Fascinating stuff. We are coming up on our time here. So it's about 20 minutes after. So we're going to have to close it there. Let me just add a couple of other brief notes, which I had meant to discuss earlier, but I got so caught up in the story of this reliquary, I couldn't resist. So the impact of Constantine. Ministers wore luxurious garments and were called priests. So before that, they were not called priests. After this, they were called priests. This was not an imitation of the Old Testament. This was an imitation of the pagan priests, so I've read. The communion table became an altar. It was called an altar. Prayer was now, and folks, I have a struggle with this one, honestly. Prayer was now given kneeling as people kneeled before the emperor. Yours truly, I think that there is very good biblical reasons why we should kneel before God in prayer and adopt a posture of kneeling and of reverence and prayer. And I think we see that in the Bible when it says worship God with fear and reverence. This was apparently something that changed. Often people would stand and raise their hands and maybe lift their heads. And at that point, people kneeled down as they would kneel down to the emperor, so I've read. So again, not entirely sure what to do with that one. The point was brought home to me very forcefully when I was a student in Germany, and I visited a church, and we were always respectful and when I was growing up, but we didn't, you know, necessarily kneel down in prayer. And I was sitting there, and I had my legs crossed and my hands folded, and the next guy next to me was kneeling down, and he was offended by my actions. So he actually took my leg, threw it on the ground, and then told me that he was a very wise man, that I should learn from him. So my initial reaction is, this is interesting, I'm being assaulted in a church. wasn't sure what to do with that, a little bit offended, but to this day, I always make sure I adopt a good posture of worship and prayer. I fold my hands, close my eyes, and I never cross my legs. If I have my legs crossed, I uncross them. So if you're out there listening to this, I heard you, okay? And we're going to have to leave it there today. The notes that you have go beyond this, and we'll, of course, cover that next time.